listening to North Atlantic Radio with your hosts, Brian Zuta and Matt Rigott.
Welcome to North Atlantic Radio Podcast. This is episode number 7. My name is Brian.
I'm Matt.
And we've got an exciting lineup today. We're going to talk a little bit about WebGL. We're going to talk about this website called Take It, which is quite nice because it wraps up a lot of different topics we've talked about in the previous 6 podcasts, including web hooks and some telephony. We've got a new section called Heroes and Villains that we're going to give a try, see how it works. We've got the standard site of the week or site of the podcast, and then what books we're reading.
Yeah, so let's just get straight into this and start off with a quick section about WebGL. So everyone's just about jumped on the HTML5 bandwagon for good reason these days. Everyone's getting excited about all the new stuff we're going to get to play with and then hopefully start using in production in the next few years or so. One thing that everyone's talking about and certainly getting excited about is their canvas element, which is supported in a few of the browsers now. Safari, I think, Firefox. I don't know if Opera has it actually. Do you know if Opera has canvas support? I presume it does.
I'm not sure, but I do know there's certainly some JavaScript to rework canvas in IE. So there is a way to get it pretty much on every browser.
Yeah, and Chrome as well. Yeah, you can get it in IE with a plugin as well, can't you? And everyone's talking about the 2D context. So this, you know, drawing SVGs on the canvas and graphs and so on, and, you know, dynamic graphs. Very good, very interesting. It's kind of still a bit of Flash's thunder. But there are two different contexts for the canvas element. The first is 2D, which is the one that's getting a lot of work done to it now and getting a lot of press, and everyone's getting excited. But the other context is the 3D context. And this allows 3D graphics to be drawn straight onto the canvas. And recently in WebKit, which is the open source part of Safari, the rendering engine that Google Chrome uses, as well as Safari, the browser, they've just, into the code repository, they've just pushed what they call WebGL, which is allowing OpenGL to be used in the canvas element. So this is actually native 3D graphics that can run using the GPU on a graphics card straight into the browsers, and they've got a JavaScript binding for OpenGL, which means that you've got a JavaScript method of mucking about with 3D graphics. We'll put a link up to a video because it's quite astounding what can be done, especially given that these are early days. And I mean, what this means in the future is that you could actually have, say, World of Warcraft directly in the browser, or your favorite game directly in the browser. You wouldn't need to be on a Windows machine using DirectX. Any game that supports OpenGL could, in theory, obviously not straight away, but if they built it for the browser, they could just run straight in the browser, which is just fantastic.
Yeah, the previous benchmark for kind of website or computer software was always the Windows, Microsoft, not Pilot. Oh, what was that called? No. It was an old game, Flight Simulator. That was sort of the benchmark for the ability to render things and to check processors, was how well it ran Flight Simulator. So I wonder if something like that, or, you know, Wolfenstein 3D would be the new benchmark for how your JavaScript engine can render WebGL.
So for those who don't know, OpenGL is a 3D graphics library. It's kind of like Microsoft DirectX, except that it's not purely Windows-based. It's platform independent, and it's not run by one particular company. It's a kind of consortium-led library. And I think the Quake games are written in using OpenGL, weren't they, Brian?
I think so. I'm not 100% sure. But I mean, as you were talking, there's a few, like, even graphics cards or, you know, OpenGL accelerators and stuff.
Yeah. So if, I mean, something, if there's something like Quake or a game that was written in OpenGL, I mean, the next fantastic thing to happen would be for that to be ported to run in the browser. So if you ever see that, you heard it here first.
Yeah, it opens up a lot of interesting possibilities. So something to keep an eye on. I don't know if it's going to break in the next 6 months or next year, but it's certainly in the incubator stages to keep an eye on.
Yeah. But as we said earlier, it's in WebKit, and in fact, it's actually in the Firefox nightly builds as well. So we'll put up some links so you can see some videos of it in action, and we can all look forward to the future.
In 3D.
Okay, and next is a new section we're bringing in called Heroes and Villains. This is where we just have a brief section of the podcast where we talk about some company or somebody who's done something great since the last podcast, and then somebody or some company that's done something bad since the last podcast. And we'll each have a hero and a villain, and we'll just discuss it briefly and then link to more information in the show notes. So I'm going to kick this off, and I'm going to go for my hero. Is a company you may have heard of called Google, and they're my hero this week for Chrome Frame, which has just come out, and absolutely fantastic. I'm sure you'll have heard of it because it's the big news of the moment, but it's Google Chrome Frame is a plugin for Internet Explorer 6, I think, that allows web developers to use the Chrome rendering engine, so WebKit, in Internet Explorer 6. And they provide a JavaScript, so you get something very similar to Flash, where if you go to a page, you can just say, oh, well, you don't have the Chrome plugin installed. You need to install this plugin to view this page. Just click here, and then seamlessly it'll download the plugin, and then bang, your site will be running the WebKit renderer in Internet Explorer 6. Absolutely fantastic. Possibly not going to get anywhere, because the big problem people have with Internet Explorer 6 is that they can't upgrade it because they're in a big company, and their company's IT department won't let them upgrade, and if they can't do that, they might not be able to install a plugin either, so it may be a bit of a dead fish, but they're my hero this week for that reason. And they're also, for this inaugural Heroes and Villains section, my villain for their equally recently released SideWiki, which is just this another attempt at an idea that comes up every so often to control the conversation that's going along on the web. So as far as I was concerned, comments are working quite nicely on websites. I write something on my blog, you can comment, that works okay. Google obviously thought differently and has decided that comments should be done on their system, not on my website. Fortunately, SideWiki probably won't go anywhere because you have to have the Google toolbar installed. And then once you've got the toolbar installed, you have to have SideWiki installed. So the number of people using this will be fairly small, but we'll do some more links in the show notes to that as well to see what to show why I think it's such a poor idea.
Would you think it was better if it was more of a distributed system to where you would install maybe something on your own website, and then when you came to xyz.com, you can leave notes, personal notes, just for yourself?
No, I don't think that would work either. I think the systems co-comment is one, and Discuss is another that are fairly similar. They're this centralized system. Discuss works because the comments just appear on your site like they would any other commenting system, and you still have control over that.
I'm saying not necessarily not as a replacement for commenting systems, but if me as John Doe browser or John Doe web surfer visited, you know, google.com, I can annotate a note just for myself.
Yeah, no, that would be fine, but that's a completely different product. SideWiki is public and in total, you know, everything you write can be seen by everyone else.
Yeah, so okay, just wanted to clarify where the hang up, where your evil villain part is.
Right, okay.
I guess my heroes and villains for this inaugural presentation, I've already messed up because I couldn't think of a hero this week.
You're so pessimistic.
I'm already behind the ball. but my villain is the perennial Apple for their whole iTunes app store fiascos of, you know, banning people, and now the Google Voice is flaring up again, and it's just... I think Tim Bray had a great quote about the whole app store. He said it was like picking up dimes in front of a bulldozer. And really, the way, you know, does everything need an app store at the moment? That was another, someone had tweeted about, you know, app stores are the new cameras. You know, everything has a camera in it. Everything needs an app store. So I'm very much against this whole, again, centralized system. That seems to be the running theme on villains this week. So... Uh-huh. Given that this is their seventh podcast, we found a really interesting company called Take It, and it kind of exemplifies a lot of the things that we've been talking about in the previous six podcasts. So we wanted to kind of feature this and talk a little further about it. It's spelled TAYKT.com, and it's spelled kind of strange like that because it's part of the phone short code 82958, and those letters, those numbers spell out Take It, so they've tried to make it a little easier to remember. And the concept behind Take It is a short code SMS auto reply service. And you can send it, well, you sign up with them, and you basically kind of get or request a keyword. So in my case, you can type SUDA, S-U-D-A, and send a text to 82958. They'll charge you 25p, but it'll auto-respond, or should auto-respond, with information that I've typed in. So it's really good for maybe small events or a band or some sort of, you see it on a poster, text FUBAR to 82958 or, Take It, and it'll auto-reply with some info about maybe when the next concert is or when the next event is. And we were kind of brainstorming. It'd be really cool for, the Edinburgh Fringe or the Movie Fest where you can type in the name of the film, and it would just reply, auto-reply back with the movie, the showtime, the next showtime. But the reason we like Take It is because they've done a whole lot of interesting things with webhooks, as well as a pretty advanced API to allow you to easily read and write and create these sort of terms. So we've been kind of brainstorming crazy ideas like the magic eight ball or horoscopes or lottery numbers, and you could even go as far as setting up a keyword to yourself, and it'll just reply back with how many emails are waiting in your inbox or all sorts of crazy things. I mean, do you have a couple of ideas?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm just generally really interested in this system because, wandering around Glasgow, you see posters all the time, this band's playing here, but always at the bottom, it's got a little, short code, text 86557 or whatever and get more information. And presumably, I've never done it, but you text it and it just sends back the website address or the next gig or something like that. And I'd love to be able to play with those systems, and Take It offers you exactly that. And you can just have it set up so it's an autoresponder, but like Brian's saying, you've got a full API and webhooks that allows you to say, whenever someone texts this number with my code, just send me the information and I'll return you a message that you then text back to them. So you can make it dynamic. So you could ask people to text in their postcode and you could give them geographic information from it.
I think it's really good as well because it's the concept is less about building a product and more about building a platform. So they've enabled, I'm sure they're smart guys, but they can only think of so many crazy ideas, whereas they've built a nice API and platform, and there's going to be loads more ideas and products built on top of it that they could have either imagined or even had the time to do.
Yeah. I mean, being up in Scotland, the Edinburgh Festival has been a big thing about a month ago at least. We were brainstorming ideas about that, like how could we use this system? And there's about at least 250 venues in the festival spread all over the city. And they've all got numbers and they all have these massive signs outside saying what number venue they are. So it makes it easy for you to find out where you are and where you've got to go. But you could even just do a system as simple as you're walking along, you see you're at venue 35, text Fringe 35 to the Take It short code, and it'll send back all the acts that are happening within the next 4 hours at that venue or something like that.
Even the perennial problem with train times as well, getting to and from Edinburgh.
Yeah. Text what station you're at, where you want to go. It sends back the number of trains or anything like that. So, I mean, the idea is fantastic. And their API and their webhooks are really worth a look because they make it so easy for you to do this. Brian and I have been talking about it a lot this last week. And the one thing, and I'm sure this is something they'll look at in the future, but you can't actually make any money from Take It at the moment. If you text the short code, you get charged 25p and Take It take all 25 pence. So you can't actually make any money from this at all. So when you're sending messages, you're sending it just for the goodness of your own heart. Now, I'm sure in the future they'll look at a way to say, well, we're going to take 25p. You tell us how much you want to charge and you get the difference. So if you want to charge 50 pence a message, you'll get at the 25p on top of the 25p we take. In which case, that would be absolutely fantastic, because you could build a website around events on the city, plaster the short code all over the place, and you know, you can have yourself a nice little earner coming in. And the fact that this system is available, I love APIs, I love webhooks, and this sort of thing is becoming available is just brilliant.
Yeah, so I highly recommend everybody to take a look at the website. It's takeit.com, TAYKT.com.
Now we move on to our site of the episode. This week, this episode, sorry, it's a website called 280 Slides, 280slides.com. It's been around for a while, but I just had reason to use it recently and realized how absolutely brilliant it is. I'm a big fan of Google Docs, but to be fair, the system is fantastic, but the interface is absolutely awful. And I came across 280 Slides when I was needing to do a presentation, and the interface for 280 Slides is just fantastic. It looks very much like a Mac application, and it works really, really well. So if you need to do any presentations and you know, create PowerPoints or PDFs, I would heartily recommend it. It's well worth a look. 280slides.com. For the nerds in our audience, which I'm sure is everyone, it's interesting to note that although, of course, the website itself is written in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, the programmers actually written everything in a language they created called Objective-J, which is like a cross between JavaScript and Objective-C, Apple's programming language.
Coca.
Yeah, and what they do is they write in an Objective-C, and then they compile it down into JavaScript. And the system that does that is called Cappuccino, and it's open source. I've had a look at it myself, but I just haven't got the time to learn Objective-J, but it's interesting to see how they've overcome the problem of writing web apps. The site itself is well worth a look as well.
Yeah, it's funny that 2 weeks in a row now we've had presentation software as site of the week.
Yeah, what have we been doing?
Yeah, ta-da. All right, we finally leave you with our thoughts about what we've been reading this week. I've got, I think, about three books on the go. One is called Images of the City, and it kind of profiles, it's an old book from the 60s or 70s, and it profiles three major cities, Boston, New Jersey City, and L.A., and it kind of just going through the pros and cons of how the city was developed and the different thoroughfares, and it's a really interesting book, and I think the thing that's going to be the most interesting is the book is only about half of it is the book, and the other half is the appendix. That's the only book I've ever had with about 50% of it being the appendix. That's massive. But the good thing is in the appendix, they kind of walk you through their entire thought process, how many people they got to interview, because they got people to interview and draw a map of the city. And then they realized, hang on a sec, there's lots of streets these people are omitting because they're only thinking of the major thoroughfares or, you know, major parks, or they completely missed other major parks. So I'm really interested in, you know, potentially doing that for Reykjavik or other cities as well. And the appendix is going to be an invaluable resource on how they went about doing it. The other book that I finished reading is called Paradox of Choice by Barry Schwartz. And he did a TED Talk. And it's an interesting book, but if you watch the sort of 20-minute TED Talk, there's not a whole lot more in the book that he didn't go over. I mean, maybe there might be one or two gems, but the TED Talk really sums it up nicely. And finally, on those same lines, I also got a book called Predictably Irrational. And the author, Dan Ehrle, also did a TED Talk, and we'll link to it in the show notes. And the book covers a lot of the same information. And I realized some of it sounded familiar as well, because it's also in Freakonomics. So there's a lot of crossover. If you like Freakonomics, Predictably Irrational is probably a good book as well. But it seems to be a bit more meaty information than what was in the TED Talk. So I'll put all the stuff in the show notes. Really enjoying it.
Okay, the books I've been reading. Regular listeners will recognize a book called In Premature, which I have now been reading for, I think this is the third podcast. And I was very excited when I first got it. I thought this is going to be incredible. And it's turned out to be not incredible. I think there's a lot of reasons why, but I'm still struggling through it. I'm a big believer in, if you're not enjoying a book, just, you know, drop it and get on with something else, because there's billions of books out there, and there's more books that I want to read than I'll be able to read. So dump the books you're not enjoying. But I'm going to struggle through with this one a bit more just to make sure it's definitely not worth carrying on with. Second book, for people who read my blog, they'll know I went a bit mad about architecture recently. And there's a book, European Architecture from 1750 to 1890, which I'm working through now. And that's incredible. It's got some very obscure architectural styles and architects just doing crazy things that didn't get accepted. And some of the some of their proposals are just fantastic. And third book, I just
hang on along the real quick. Didn't you start a Wikipedia page as well?
Yes, and I had to run out and run around two different libraries just to get this book, so I could find out who it was quoting, so I could source the article in Wikipedia. Yeah. And the third and final book is Robert McFarlane's The Wild Places, which I haven't opened yet, but I was reading about it the other week. Sounded fantastic. Got it through Amazon. It just arrived today, so I'll let you know in the next podcast how that goes.
Well, thank you very much for listening. That was the 7th episode of North Atlantic Radio. As always, you can email us at hello@northatlanticradio.com. We're trying out some new things here and there, heroes and villains. Last week's podcast was a little longer than normal, so we're trying to tweak the formula. We're always interested in your feedback, so please give us an email or just send us something on Twitter or mention us, and we'll find you.